Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does anything get done in a polarized political climate? And will the Obama administration ultimately be any more willing or able to compromise with its opponents than the Bush administration that preceded it? Will that even be necessary? John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, and he writes about politics for the New York Times. Along with Gerald Seeb, he analyzes how business really gets done in the nation's capital and reveals how much important work is undertaken by men and women who are not elected and often not even well known outside Beltway circles. The book has just been re-released in paperback with a new foreword. It's called Pennsylvania Avenue: Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. John, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
You write that the election of 2008 was ultimately about how Pennsylvania Avenue works or doesn't work. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think the American people over the last several years, and it was inflamed by unhappiness with Iraq, but it really goes deeper than that, was looking at a political system that certainly through the latter part of the Clinton years was so polarized and paralyzed that it was unable to tackle national problems from health care to energy. And part of Barack Obama's appeal was beyond his own individual charisma, but the idea that he was a younger leader, he wasn't rooted in those old fights, and he was going to be able to turn the page and do something different. And that's the challenge that's still before him in Washington, even though he's off to a strong start.
You have in the book a fascinating case study of the much maligned Dubai Ports World deal that shocked so many people when it first came to light. But you know, although it had been quiet at the beginning, it never really was a secret. Can you talk about how the first media outlets that covered that really shaped the way it was perceived?
Well, it was really interesting. You know, this was a story that was getting matter-of-fact coverage in places like the Miami Herald and the Wall Street Journal. Nobody took much notice of this deal. And the national security community, frankly, Chris, didn't think it was that big a deal that this company was going to be taking over management of these U.S. ports. But then what happened was it got picked up on talk radio, ricocheted around, all of a sudden on opinion cable, on Fox in particular. This became a cause celeb. It was fueled in part by a lobbyist who was worried that his company, the company that he represented, was going to lose business out of this deal. And all of a sudden, Democrats picked it up. They saw it was a way to embarrass the Bush administration. Republicans then abandoned the Bush administration. You had a period of uncertainty. Bush threatened a veto. And the whole thing ended up collapsing, even though at the end of the day, few people who were watching it closely thought it was actually a threat, but it became to be perceived as one, and it was something that politicians decided they simply couldn't stand in the way of.
Yeah, and it became something that Republicans in Congress finally had something that they could cling to that helped them to begin before these critical elections to separate from the positions of the Bush administration.
Yes, and we saw how much good that did them because in American politics, once things start going downhill for you, they keep rolling downhill. This was a case where it was actually a bipartisan failure, if you will, because, again, if you talk privately to some of the leading Democrats who were pushing this issue, as well as the Republicans, I don't think they were terribly convinced in the argument that they were making, but they realized that there was political hay to be had in stopping it. And that's eventually what happened.
Ultimately, this is such an interesting coda. Of course, Dubai Ports World sold its U.S. interest to AIG.
Yeah, exactly.
But despite AIG's troubles, from what I understand, the ports business is still going fairly well. Is that right?
Yeah, the ports business is going fine. AIG's problems really had to do with this hedge fund that was grafted on top of this insurance business that happened, unfortunately, for the American people and for AIG shareholders to guarantee all of these bad loans that really were the sort of crystallization of the housing and credit bubbles that have burst to such catastrophic results for the U.S. economy.
John, how much power does a president have in the current climate for either solidifying or unlocking political gridlock as compared with the legislature?
Well, it's interesting. The president's always the focal point of our system. And this is a president who is unusually powerful at this stage of his term. Remember, he got a 53% majority. That's bigger than Bill Clinton ever got. That's bigger than George Bush managed to pull off. And the decisiveness of that win, the fact that the American people wanted change so profoundly, has given him a lot of clout. Now, it hasn't, as we saw in the stimulus debate, overridden the partisan divide that led zero House Republicans to vote for his stimulus package. So he's got a lot of work to do, but when you look at the polls, we had an NBC Wall Street Journal poll recently showing Barack Obama with a 61% job approval rating, but even more striking than that, 80% of the American people say they like him, including a large chunk of Republicans. So that's a good amount of political capital for him to work with.
Of course, there are the arguments made that at this point, Republicans in Congress can't really say that they don't like the president because they know that the American people are behind him. So they can vote against him, but they can say, but he's a great guy.
Yes, and certainly that's what they're doing so far. It's really going to be put to the test when we get to the health care debate, to the energy debate. How does Barack Obama maneuver? Do we have a result that falls along party lines like the stimulus debate, or is it more regional? Is it something that is more variegated as Obama tries to pick off some of those skeptics? For example, in the energy debate, it looks like this controversial cap-and-trade idea of, in essence, putting a tax on carbon is falling by the wayside. How does Barack Obama replace it in his energy package? There's talk that he might include some offshore oil drilling. Well, you remember, Chris, the 2008 campaign, what was the Republican energy plan? Drill, drill, drill. So maybe he can attract some votes that way.
How significant is it that both the president and his chief of staff not only have legislative experience, but were Democratic legislators at a time when the GOP had this extraordinary amount of power?
Well, Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, is an interesting character, and he played a big role in our book. He's somebody who has played so many roles that are relevant to where we are right now. He was a top aide in the Clinton White House and therefore a big player in those partisan wars in the 1990s that Barack Obama has always proudly said he wasn't part of. He worked on Wall Street for a while. He made a fortune working in private equity. And then he was a member of Congress. But Rahm Emanuel's hallmark as a member of Congress, as he tried to lead successfully the effort for Democrats to win back control, was that he was able to play toward the middle, capture districts where Democrats had not been competitive, curb some of the further left reaches of his party in the interest of getting a national majority. And that's a skill that Barack Obama certainly wants him to bring to bear in all the legislative debates we're now facing.
Of course, it's notable that even when Rahm Emanuel sort of led the charge to take back Democratic control of the House in 2006, that did nothing to chip away at the partisanship that exists there.
Well, that's true. And this is one of the things about the way our parties have sorted themselves out in the last 20 years or so, really since Ronald Reagan became president, lured a lot of conservative Democrats over to the Republican column. It's left us with parties that are fairly homogenous ideologically. Republicans are a conservative party. They've got a somewhat larger base than Democrats. Democrats need to get more independents than Republicans do. And Democrats are the liberal party. Right now, you've seen, because of the disaffection with Bush and disaffection with the course of the country during late part of Bush's term, you've seen a lot of Republicans become independents, and independents lean strongly toward the Democrats. So it's given Obama the upper hand and given him the possibility of breaking through in ways that Bill Clinton might not have had.
Well, you talk about the parties being fairly homogenized. You also point out the fact that many congressional and legislative districts are very politically polarized themselves, so you have fewer and fewer representatives of either party who are really obligated once they get back home to try and please sort of a diverse group of voters.
Exactly, and that's one of the things that makes the polarization so difficult to break. The action in House politics, by and large, is in primary elections. That means if you're a Republican member of Congress, what you've got to worry about is not beating the Democrat, because the district is likely to be so stacked in your favor that in a general election you've got a very strong a chance of winning. But it's getting challenged from the right in a Republican primary, and if you're a Democrat, it's getting challenged from the left. So that pushes both incumbents in both parties to the ideological fringe and makes it more difficult to compromise in the middle. Barack Obama inherits that alignment when he's going to try to break through and forge some way of achieving consensus in the middle. It's not going to be easy.
So primary season aside, I have to imagine that a lot of the infighting within parties is going to take place behind closed doors because they don't want to present anything but a united front when they're out in front of the public, but they've got to sort these issues out among themselves.
Well, that's true, but it's hard, certainly when you're governing, to avoid the public display of those disputes. Look what's happening in energy legislation now. You've got a split between Democrats on the left who want to keep pressing this cap-and-trade plan to limit carbon emissions. And you've got moderate and conservative Democrats, especially those representing energy states, who are resisting that because they think it's going to hurt business in their states. That's where you get some of the regional factors coming into play, as well as the ideological factors. One of the unfortunate things that happens to parties when they gain power, which, of course, they want to do, is that the larger your majority is, the more variegated it is, and Democrats are in that happy position, I guess, now, because you've got almost 260 votes for Democrats in the House, and when Al Franken gets eventually seated, as I think he will be, they're going to have 60 votes with Arlen Specter in the Senate, and that gives them a chance to do some business.
Is there any reason to believe that, although Specter certainly has changed parties, that he will always then vote with the Democrats, given his history?
Not always, but more likely than he used to. There's a certain tribal identification that takes over when you align with a caucus. That does not mean that Arlen Specter is going to vote down the line with Barack Obama. But on those filibuster votes, on those votes that are deemed to be party line exercises, he's going to face a lot of pressure to go along, and I suspect that he will. Just as Arlen Specter had been tacking to the right because he was concerned about a primary election, which was the kind of thing we were talking about in House races before, you can expect that now that Democrats are his primary constituency, he may have a primary challenge from a Democrat before the Senate election next year. He's going to have to mind his base now, his new base.
How do you think that gridlock affects public opinion and public trust in leadership?
Well, I think it's very corrosive because people look. How many presidents, Chris, have the American people heard say, we're going to kick our addiction to foreign oil? It's happened since Richard Nixon. We're as addicted as we've ever been. And that's partly what Barack Obama is counting on, that there is such a level of disgust and alienation among Americans that they're going to swing behind him as he says he's going to do something different. That also heightens the stakes, I think, if he ends up disappointing. And, as high as he is in the polls right now, that can come crashing down if people decide he's just another politician. But right now, people see Barack Obama differently, and part of it's youth, part of it's that he's the first African-American. That means, by definition, that's change, and that's something new. So I think the window is open. The question is whether he can climb through it.
As far as you can tell, is he maximizing this good feeling that he's got for now?
I think he absolutely is. I think he's off to an extremely strong start. It couldn't have gone much better. He got the stimulus package that he wanted in almost the size that he wanted. He got it rapidly so that its effects can be felt in the economy later this year. Obama's talked lately about good signs in the economy and the gears of the economic engine beginning to turn again. And that's just as the stimulus is starting to hit right now. So that's fortuitous timing for him, although he certainly has to hope that unemployment rate comes down soon. But that's a strong start, and it kind of sets the table, especially if people begin feeling more confident, for the legislative debates that are really the meat of his agenda. Getting the economy off its back is just the starter, really, to solidify the economic foundation that he's talked about laying for the long term. He really needs to get health care reform and energy reform, and he's pushing very hard on both fronts.
John Harwood is here. We're talking about his new book, Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power Making Washington Work Again. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Harwood. He is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and also a political writer for the New York Times. His book has just been re-released with a new foreword in paperback. It's called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk about the division between right and left in this country and why it seems so much deeper in these first years of the 21st century than it has in the past. For one thing, you write about the fact that relationships across the aisle today are not nearly as likely as once they were to be personal among lawmakers.
Well, it's the reason for that is it's become so easy and expected for lawmakers to spend most of their time when they're not actually on the floor of the chamber back home in their districts politicking, and it means that they have little time actually to develop friendships across the aisle. Because the parties have sorted ideologically, if you also don't have that element of personal contact, there's really nothing in common these members have. I was struck over the weekend by talking to a Republican member of Congress from Texas, Pete Sessions, who heads the Republican Campaign Committee, and he views Barack Obama as somebody who is more or less set out to kill the free enterprise system. Well, that is not when you have that strong a view toward the president of the opposing party, it's very hard for Pete Sessions to justify doing any legislation with this president. And that's the gap that Barack Obama is trying to reach across.
And on the one hand, it might seem overly simplistic to think that if Pete Sessions were, you know, in the Capitol playing handball or jogging with Democrats, that this would be entirely different. But in fact, in the past, things like this occurred and people did sort of understand each other better.
Well, yes, people recognized, I mean, and I grant you, Pete Sessions is an extreme case given the depth of his discontent with Obama. But there's no question that once you have a greater understanding of the person that you're arguing with on the floor of the chamber, it makes a difference. We told a story in our book of Jim McCrary of Louisiana, who was one of those members of Congress who was going home every week. And in fact, the toll of going home was such that he was going to retire from Congress. His wife then, who was a college professor back home in Shreveport, where he was had his district, said, no, I want you to stay in Congress a little while longer. We'll move the family to Washington. They moved down the street from a Democrat, who's also from Texas, Chet Edwards, who Jim McCrary had raised money to try to defeat for election after election. And then their kids joined the same soccer team. And he said, you know what? I'm not going to try to knock off the father of my kid's teammate. And so you had a different relationship between that Republican and that Democrat than existed before, simply because they were neighbors and you know, raising their kids together.
How much impact does the fact that we can communicate instantaneously? You know, everybody talks all the time now about members of Congress twittering all the time, and everything that gets said is pretty much instantly on a world stage. What impact does that have on the way Washington works?
Well, I think the velocity, Chris, of communication is something that you're very right to point to, because from blogs to talk radio to the instant sort of email bombardment that members of Congress get whenever they say something controversial or prepare to do something controversial has a bit of a paralyzing effect on members. It's one of the reasons why Barack Obama has talked about trying not to get caught up in the day-to-day. He makes a point of joking, for those of us who work in television, that he tries not to watch too much cable TV. He tries not to follow the minute-by-minute movements of the stock market, which is another piece of that information which feeds the conversation, especially when we talk about economic issues. It's hard to slow down, think about the national interest, think about the long term, and it's one of the things that Obama's pushing back against.
And one thing that's very interesting, you know, you mentioned cable TV. There is, of course, still network TV and network TV news, but it's become less and less relevant as time has gone on.
Well, no question about it. We talk in our book with Elliot Abrams, who was a national security official under President Reagan and under President Bush. He talked about how in the Reagan era, they used to organize their day around the message that they were trying to put out on the network news. And the big three, CBS, ABC, NBC, the pictures and the words that went out on those newscasts really represented the common conversation that the country was having. But because of cable, because of the internet, those audiences are shrinking year by year. And now network news is much less a part of the thinking and the planning of the White House. Instead, they're looking at driving that nonstop news cycle through places like the Drudge Report and the Huffington Post and all the other sites that can instantly ricochet information around, as well as, I might say, CNBC and MSNBC, where I spend part of my days working.
Yeah, and I guess there's two ways of looking at that, because on the one hand, one could argue that there's not sort of that time, even with a daily broadcast deadline or newspaper deadline, to really process something before a message goes out. On the other hand, there are a lot more avenues, if you have a sort of extreme position, to make sure that you get heard if you're a lawmaker.
No question about it. And you know, the problem, we've been talking in the country over the last few weeks, and Obama was joking about it, at the White House Correspondents' Center over the weekend, about the crisis in journalism, the crisis for newspapers in particular, which is where I grew up, and I'm the son of a newspaper man. I grew up in that world, and it's wrenching for me to see what's happening. But it's not because there isn't a market for information or for journalism. It's the form that the information takes. There are so many outlets now, and Barack Obama has embraced presidential communication more aggressively than anybody that we've seen. Look at him going on ESPN before the college basketball tournament. Look at him putting his Saturday radio addresses on YouTube. He is using all the elements of...
John, we're getting some breakup there, so we're going to call you right back and try and make sure that we can get this line on so that we can hear you again. John Harwood is my guest. He is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. He's also a political writer for The New York Times. He's written a book with Gerald Seeb called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. The book was initially released last year, did very well, and now has been updated with a new foreword that looks at the way the Obama administration specifically is handling the new realities of how power is wielded and shared in Washington and how deals are made behind closed doors and also on the floor of the House and of the Senate. If you would like to join our conversation, we do have lines open. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and our email address is think@kera.org. Do we have you back again, John?
I'm back. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
What I was saying was that Obama has embraced the full range of communication in a way that we simply haven't seen, both the internet, all means of television communication, and it's a way that he's getting his message out pretty effectively.
Is it problematic that even in the most sort of staid broadcast forum, the politicians who say things that are somewhat outrageous are the ones that make headlines in all those other places?
Yes. And it's one of the things that I wrestle with as someone working in cable news. The maximum cable news is the more outrageous, the better, because that's what keeps people from clicking the channel and going to watch something else. So you've got to find a way to make the news compelling and interesting without distorting it. And unfortunately, a lot of people who go on television go for maximum attention, and that means you're saying things that are outrageous, ridiculous in some cases. Honestly, some of the kind of fabricated debates that take place are things that are not helpful to the system. And I should say, thank goodness for public radio, because public radio is one place where the conversation is pretty sane.
Well, you know, what's really fascinating is that it's very difficult to be a successful, at least elected, politician today without being something of a celebrity at the same time.
Yes, celebrity certainly helps, but I do think there are solid members of Congress who know how to work the levers, who may not be public celebrities, but they're private Capitol Hill celebrities, and they're able to get things done. We talk in our book about a young woman named Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who has actually become sort of famous over the last several months because she made public her fight with breast cancer, And to tell you how secret she had kept that fight while she was serving quite effectively as a member of Congress, I interviewed her repeatedly for the chapter that we did in our book, and it was on her success as an inside player, as a fundraiser, as somebody who knew how to work the levers of power in just her first or second term. And through that time, she was being treated for breast cancer, and I didn't even know it. She never told me. I never noticed any absence for any length of time that would be noticeable. And it's she's a remarkable person, and she's not a national celebrity except for health reasons now that have come public in television interviews, but she was getting things done long before that.
You also read about a woman named Leah Berman, who was White House Social Secretary under President Bush, and you write that like a good spy, in that position, one is most successful when nobody notices his or her presence. And she certainly succeeded there.
Leah Berman tried to keep as low profile as possible while serving as White House Social Secretary. And it's a challenging job, especially when if your job is sort of greasing the wheels of business in town with the social life, how do you overcome the partisan polarization? Because her job is not purely partisan or legislative. It's really serving the first lady of the country, who is usually superintends most of the social life at the White House. But what she was finding, which was different from a past generation of social secretary, there were strict limits on how many members of the other party that she could invite, and there was more pressure from the political side than she had been than her predecessors had been used to dealing with. But it's a job that ends up behind the scenes making a big difference. We tell the story of a dinner or a lunch, actually, that was held with the Chinese leader coming to see President Bush, and there was a lot of push and pull over who was going to sit where, and you had a Chinese diplomat trying to change the seating chart. She ended up, Leah had to grab one of the chairs and order somebody to hold it to keep the order that she wanted affected.
Physically,
one of those people the Americans, the ordinary American people will never meet, but it has a large impact.
Yeah, she needed someone to physically sit in that chair. I mean, it's funny because you think about all of this being done at a very sort of high level, and it comes down in some cases to actually.
Possession is 9/10 of the law, and it certainly was for that chair at that lunch.
What do you think are the most important unwritten rules of Pennsylvania Avenue politics?
Well, the unwritten rule of Pennsylvania Avenue at the moment, and I say this with some regret, is take care of your base first. And that's something that we saw from President Clinton when he served, both in good times and bad. You saw it under President Bush. You see it from Barack Obama in the early parts of his administration. As long as we have a system where the only really reliable friends you have are going to be in your own party, taking care of your base first is going to be the unwritten first principle of Pennsylvania Avenue. Can Barack Obama blur some of those lines? Can he create a different kind of politics by the force of his personality and his charisma and some of his less orthodox proposals? We'll see. That's going to be an uphill fight even for him.
You know, the question of taking care of the base is really an interesting one because, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, President Obama won 53% of the vote. President Bush in the last couple of elections was, you know, close to 50%. This is not a huge majority of Americans one way or another that seems to, at least with the election of a president, absolutely go for one party or the other. Are politicians maybe misinterpreting the willingness of the American voter to consider other ideas?
That's possible, and it's certainly one of the things that if you ask people in a poll, they would say of President Bush toward the end of his term that they thought he was stubborn. Right now, that dynamic is working to the benefit of Democrats and to the disadvantage of Republicans. In the recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll that I mentioned, when you ask people how has have the Republicans in Congress been in dealing with Obama, 55% said they've been too stubborn and not cooperating. That indicates that Obama has the goodwill to start with, and he has the opportunity to make the case. But again, even in the in the favorable circumstances of the beginning of his presidency, when there was wide agreement on left and right that we needed a major economic stimulus, the particular shape of the package that pushed through the Congress was such that the Democrats were not able to get a single Republican in the House, just three Republicans in the Senate. And it just shows how difficult and how large that ideological divide really is.
Have you seen any sign whatsoever that congressional Democrats currently are making any effort whatsoever to sort of restrain themselves from trying to, maybe there's a better word than this, but trying to avenge the recent history of GOP leadership?
Well, this is one of the interesting stakes of the fight over a so-called truth commission. You have some Democrats, Pat Leahy in the Senate and others, Nancy Pelosi in the House, has said she's in favor of this as well, who want to investigate the handling of terror suspects after 9/11. Some of them want to prosecute people who engaged in those techniques or authorized or provide legal justification for those techniques. And I think Barack Obama, in the clearest signal yet that he's hoping to stay out of that most intense kind of partisan wrangling, is saying, no, let's don't look back, let's look forward. How that comes out, Democrats are not yet giving up. Some say we're going to keep trying to arrange a commission. I think if Obama prevails, and I do expect him to, that is one step that he's going to take and earn some goodwill from Republicans for having taken it.
John Harwood is my guest. He is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. He also writes about politics for the New York Times. His new book, written with Gerald Sieb, is called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. It has just been re-released with a new foreword in paperback. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Chief CNBC Washington correspondent and New York Times political writer John Harwood. His book has just been re-released in paperback with a new foreword. It's called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We cannot have this conversation without talking about the extraordinary power of the lobby in modern politics. If I remember correctly, there are twice as many lobbyists working in the nation's capital today as there were in 2000?
There are, and, you know, it's partly related to how complex the economy has become, how international the economy has become, all of those interests that have a stake in government policy, and they're more than ever, have representation in the Capitol. You've also had a whole army of social issue, environmental issue, all manner of interest groups have developed the capacity to make themselves heard in Washington. And it's one of the things that Barack Obama ran against. Interestingly enough, Obama has set very strict rules restricting what sort of lobbyists can what sort of interaction they can have with his administration, and barring registered federal lobbyists from working in his administration. Some liberals are now complaining that that has kept out some past environmental lobbyists or people who'd lobbied for what they consider good government groups. But Barack Obama meant what he said about trying to do something different, and therefore he's living with that consequence.
Does that proliferation of lobbyists, such as it still exists, have the same impact that the multiple media outlets have, in that there are so many of them that each one sort of dilutes the power of all the rest to have an impact?
Yes, but I think they do have power, in particular because lobbyists are really the engine for the campaign finance system. That the way that lobbyists make their influence felt on members of Congress is by helping them raise the money they need to stay in office, not just stay in office, but to rise in Congress. You know, we talked, Chris, about the polarized districts in Congress and how so many people have their elections, in effect, predetermined by the selection of their constituents. But nevertheless, members raise tons of money, even if they're safe, to give to other people who may not be safe as a way of winning influence. Lobbyists make that engine go, and that's where they get a lot of their clout from.
What kinds of changes have you observed in the way ideas and policies are spun from the Capitol?
Well, I would say over the course of my lifetime, Chris, the parties, this process of sorting out left and right has become, if not perfected, much more advanced than it was before. So each party, we talked about them being relatively homogenous. The competition tends to be for a few voters in the center, but also for trying to craft your arguments in a way that maximizes public appeal of policies that don't change all that much. In other words, the liberals and conservatives have fostered a consistent set of ideas in election after the election, but who can effectively argue that their election suits the moment that we're in and that those ideas are something that would appeal to the widest degree across the spectrum is who comes out on top.
Is there any reason to believe that America would, in fact, be a stronger place if more politicians and more voters did move closer to the center?
That's a very subjective question, and it's not an easy one to answer. Just because there's a political middle doesn't necessarily mean the middle is right. To me, probably the most constructive thing is for one side or the other to get enough working control of the government to get their program through and let it be tested. Now, Obama and the Democrats argue that that's precisely what's happened since Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, that you had an ascendant conservatism in the country that emphasized lower taxes, curbs on domestic program spending, less regulation of American business. And they're arguing that system has crashed and burned, and now it's time for something new. Certainly Republicans would say many of their ideas were not implemented, and you can't ascribe the difficulties we're in now to conservative economic policy. But if you have a system where one side gets a program through and it's clearly accountable to the American people and people can make a judgment, that's probably the best system.
I'm thinking about all the obsession that we've had in recent weeks over sort of counting out the successes and failures of the first 100 days of the Obama administration. And his is not the first, obviously, in recent history to be looked at in this way. But I wonder if you think that we're doing ourselves a disservice by trying to constantly be able to get fully on top of what's going on and assess things before we've had the benefit of a few years of history to really digest what's worked and what hasn't.
Chris, I could not agree with you more. And the 100 days, you know, the Obama people who tried to shape the coverage joked about it as being a Hallmark holiday, and that's exactly right. You know, I said before that Barack Obama was off to a strong start. But almost all of the chapters of this book are yet to be written. We don't know. All we know is that he got, at a moment of maximum economic crisis and anxiety, he got a stimulus package through. But the broader elements of his vision for how to change the country, change the foundations of our economy, change the course of our national security policy, we simply don't know how he's going to do. And the idea that we can sit around and make judgments and give a sort of instant thumbs up or thumbs down on what Barack Obama is going to become is simply impossible. That's one of the things that he was joking about at the correspondence dinner about how he was going to create a museum to his first 100 days and it was a way of poking fun of the enterprise that we've all been part of.
Yeah, I heard him also say that it went so well that he was able to do it in 72 days.
Yeah, exactly.
You spoke to Rahm Emanuel recently about how his relationship to the president has had to evolve since they went from being colleagues to being essentially employer and employee. Would you talk a little bit about what he told you?
Yes, I thought this was interesting. Rahm Emanuel is somebody who was a big shot in Bill Clinton's White House before Barack Obama held any elected office of any kind. And then he encouraged Obama's career as Obama came up in Illinois politics. Now, all of a sudden, Obama's the most powerful man in the world, and Rahm Emanuel's his aide. And the biggest change that that's made is once they were friends, when you're the chief of staff to the president of the United States, it's not really healthy to think of yourself as that person's friend, because you've got to be very cold-blooded about the advice that you give and the loyalty that you display in a way that's it doesn't have the same mutuality of interest that you had when you were friends and peers in the Congress. They're not peers anymore.
What is changing in America? And you have a separate chapter about the new Republicans and the new Democrats. How are the parties responding? And I know that these were written actually before the current administration was mm-hmm. in place. But how are the parties responding to what exists right now?
Well, I think they were written before the current administration, but I think they're relevant. Republicans are right now facing a process of reinvention, which they have to go through. They've got to find a way to appeal to young people, to appeal to minorities, particularly Hispanics, is a likelier target for them than African Americans, and have to find a way to not present an image of affluent white country club elitist party that's aligned with business. And they also have to take care that they're not perceived as simply the handmaiden of the religious right. They can win with religious conservative support, but they have to be broader than that. And you see that in some Republicans trying to make that case. And we actually had a sad reminder of just what Republicans need now in the death of Jack Kemp, who was a former pro football quarterback. He became a congressman, a leader on tax cut issues, and somebody who was both economically conservative but very, very aggressive in pushing civil rights and help for the disadvantaged. That's the kind of message Republicans need. Democrats have a different burden. They've got to show that they're not just a secular party, that they understand people of faith. And you do see Barack Obama trying to play that card to some degree, and also younger operatives in the party.
There was so much debate over President Obama's overtures, especially to religious conservatives, even with the inauguration and the presence of Rick Warren there. Do you think that that will have sort of long-term effects for him, or is that something that everyone sees as kind of a one-shot deal?
I don't think it's a one-shot deal, and I think it was significant. And I don't think Barack Obama minded one bit all of the howls of protest that he heard from liberals over Rick Warren speaking there, because that was a way that Barack Obama could say to a very large number of people and to a new generation of evangelicals, many of whom are looking for common ground with Democrats in helping the poor, and you see this in some overseas relief and mission work, that's a way for him to say, I respect you, I honor people that that you look up to, at no cost to his substantive agenda whatsoever. I think you'll see more of that.
So I'm inferring that you don't think that we have reached the apex and are on sort of the downside of the amount of power that religious voters, either left or right, are going to continue to have in this country.
Well, I think people of faith, you know, this is remains the most church-going country in the world. And I think people of faith are going to have a lot to say about Barack Obama's success and the success of anybody running for national office. So the question is, how do you tap those spiritual side of America without looking intolerant and somebody who cuts yourself off from the experience of others? Secular people overwhelmingly are Democrats in this country, but there are not enough of them to win elections.
Do you see any real difference, and I'm not speaking just of the Bush and Obama administrations, but is there any real difference in strategy between the times when the DNC holds power in Congress as opposed to the GOP?
Well, other than the fact that the parties are different ideologically, no, I wouldn't say so. And I would say, you know, Barack Obama's talked a lot about changing the tone and a note of civility. George W. Bush did, in fact, try the same thing. He may not have tried for as long or as hard as Democrats wanted, but he made some attempts, and he bumped up against what you and I were talking about earlier, the intractability of some of those ideological differences. Those still are in the driver's seat, no matter which side is on top.
Obviously, you wrote this book to sort of reveal to the American people how much goes on in backroom sort of machinations. Do you think that it's entirely effective for a politician to try to be fully transparent about everything that goes on? Or should some of these things sort of remain behind closed doors and then we publicly see whatever it is that these meetings have yielded?
Well, Chris, there's no president who has uttered the word transparency more than Barack Obama. And yet there are some things that he has been slow to release. He eventually did release those torture memos, and that was a notable element of disclosure. But there are other things that the press has been pressing for, and events where the press is not allowed in. You can tell that even that most transparent of politicians understands that it's expedient at certain times to do your business privately, and he's doing that.
And it bears reminding people that, in fact, the torture memos were released not because the Obama administration said, hey, let's put these out, but there had been a FOIA request on the books for years.
Yes, and you know, Obama could have impeded the release of those memos, but you're right, the motive force came from that lawsuit.
So ultimately, would you say that your outlook is more optimistic than cynical? Because one way or another, the people that you profile in this book and the people that we've talked about in this interview are, in fact, getting things done.
I would say that I'm not particularly cynical, and I am fairly optimistic. I think the country is resilient. It tends to have a politics that remakes itself for the needs of the times. When we got to the 1980s, Ronald Reagan's presidency was controversial. It was not clear that he was going to win. But we saw afterwards that he had the effect of lifting the mood of the country. He changed the direction of policy in ways that some people didn't agree with, but that had a pretty profound effect and is still being felt in the country. Barack Obama is doing the same thing now. I think that's healthy. The process of change and renewal is one that never stops in American politics. And right now, it has more force and energy because of Barack Obama than we've seen in some time.
In the last few seconds, is there anybody working behind the scenes right now for either party that you think bears watching?
Oh, there's a lot of them, but there are a lot of them that I don't know about yet. That's for me to go find out in my next book.
Well, we will look forward to it. Thank you so much, John.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, and he writes about politics for The New York Times. His new book is written with Gerald Sieb, and it's called Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, Making Washington Work Again. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.